You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Nick Choksi. Nick is an incredibly versatile actor, a musician, a songwriter, and an animator. He is my husband's best friend, and we all went to Juilliard together, and he has been a rock who's helped us battle hard times more than once. I'm so happy to finally have him as a guest on The Compass. We could have talked much longer, and there were a few questions I wasn't able to ask, so I might have to have him as a guest again some point in the future. I hope you enjoy the 19th episode of The Compass.
Can you hear this?
Probably a little bit, but that's fine.
I'll take it.
That's the reality of where we are.
Yeah, I sound like Marco Rubio.
Is he known for his loud swallowing?
Yeah, there was when he gave the response to Obama,
maybe the last State of the Union, two State of the Unions ago, he gave the response, and during the speech, he just stopped speaking and went off screen to grab a bottle of water and started drinking it and made like a... He was obviously really nervous.
I do remember hearing about this. Now you mention it.
He was sweating. I think he was drinking and it was just coming right out of his face.
So today I have Marco Rubio
to talk
about his artistic career.
I believe in everything crazy.
Also known as a much more sane person called Nick Choksi.
3, 2, 1. Nick Choksi.
Well, Nick, I'm so happy that you're talking with me for the podcast, since you helped me like come up with a plan last summer when I was trying to figure it out.
And oh, man.
It really helped me a lot, so thank you.
My pleasure. It's amazing it's come so far. And I think I don't want to take all that much credit. You had the plan, and I was just like, go.
You literally lent me your audio equipment for like 8 months, so
you know,
thank you.
Audio assistance by Nick Choksi. That's
slash
me.
Let me bounce ideas off of you.
So. My pleasure.
And your beautiful wife, Stephanie, was my second guest on episode 2. So now... Now you're going to be, I think, number 19.
Number 19.
Yay.
Awesome.
So how do you try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
Well, the dark side for me feels like doubt, like anything that gets in the way of making stuff. I was thinking about this, as everybody does, you know, not wanting to... You know, come in with, here's my lecture on how I deal with it, because I don't know, you know. But it feels a little bit like, for me, it feels like the seventh grade lunchroom a little bit. Like, if I am experiencing what I would call the dark side, it's that feeling of, oh, shoot, I want to sit at the lunch table, but I don't know where to sit, and I don't know if anybody wants me to sit down. And so you just kind of, like, are paralyzed, you know? But, like... Yeah, it's like middle school. The dark side for me is like middle school. So, that being true, how do I stop from going to the dark side? Wait, is that the question?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, Nick Choksi. How do I stop from going to the dark side?
Yeah.
Because the dark side has a lot to do with doubt, I feel like talking to friends and family about what my specific doubts are really helps, because if I can name them, like, what is the voice that is telling you there's no room for you here at this lunch table? What does it sound like? Who does it sound like? And sometimes when I can localize that, it makes me, like, see how silly it is. Like, why do I feel like I am not a great singer, for example? Oh, there's a voice in my head from an ex-girlfriend who told me I'm not a great singer when I was like, you know, 16, 15, 16. And now that I've said that out loud, it sounds so dumb. And like just saying it makes me think, oh yeah, even though I'm feeling that feeling of, oh, I'm not good enough to hack it with all these other great people, that voice is coming from a voice that I can identify as like an outdated voice, a totally unrealistic and illogical fear based on some real experience I've had. It's a real feeling, but I don't know, when I say it out loud, the words of I'm afraid this person is going to think I'm X. And then I say that, and I, do I think that person is going to think I'm X? Not good enough, not smart enough, not whatever? No, I don't really. They've actually invited me to come audition for them or come, like, play for them or do a drawing for them or whatever. It's like, oh, yeah, the thing I'm afraid of is actually just me, like, cycling some old voices through my head or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And saying them out loud kind of takes the power away.
Yeah, saying them out loud kind of takes the power away. It doesn't necessarily make the feeling go away, but it definitely takes the power away and makes it easier to, like, sit down and work. I think for me, the dark side is, like, anything that gets in the way of making something. If, like, the light side is creation and, you know, progress, the dark side is anything that shuts you down or arrests you or freezes you up. And so saying what the fear is out loud tends to free up that kind of paralysis so that you can go do the thing you were trying to do in the first place.
Do you feel like it helps too, like you said, talking to friends and family, like talking to somebody who sees you as the best version of yourself and who kind of reaffirm you and be like, I have the complete faith in you and I see you as so talented and
definitely
kind of counteract that false vision you're having of yourself.
Yeah, it can. It definitely is so important to have those people who really see you and can be your cheerleaders when you need it, can, like, say what they see when they need it, when you need it. Sometimes it's like, I see you and I know you actually do that thing well, or I see you and you actually do this thing better, you know? That's very helpful, but even though it is helpful, I'm thinking about times where I have a kind of doubt in myself about something. And the other person says, like, you know, Stephanie, for example, my wife, Stephanie Thompson, episode 2, says, but hey, you're really good at that. There are times where my doubt, like, cancels out her voice, where she says, you're really good at it. I believe in you. And it's a struggle to, like, receive that because I'm, like, in my own head, I've decided I'm not good enough. I don't believe in myself in a certain vein. And even her saying that is not enough to make me believe it. So sometimes I have to, like, trust, like, I don't feel like you're right. I think I'm actually really bad at this right now, but I'm going to choose to believe you. And it's tough, but sometimes you got to, like, walk
fake
out
it,
on that
fake
limb.
Fake it till you make it.
Fake it till you make it.
feel more confident than you actually are.
Faking it till you make it is actually so great. And so, like, sometimes I look at, you know, one thing that is relatively new in my life is songwriting. I only came to it, like, maybe like 2008 or 9 when we were at school. And part of the reason is when I first picked up the guitar when I was in college, I started writing some little songs, some little, like, fun, silly songs. But there were some voices that in my life at the time that were like, hey, that's fruitless. That's, like, not a good thing to do. It's stupid, you know. Some people come into your life and are negative influences, and you can see it going back, looking back. But the reason I was able to get back into it was because there was somebody who I thought was kind of a bit of a doofus. He's a friend, but he's just kind of a doofus. And he was like, well, I just wrote this song about this. I'm really proud of it. And I thought, man, he can write a song and he's a doofus. Like, I surely can write a song. Yeah. I, in fact, had a song that I had written down in my journal like 2 years before that I just had not shared with anybody. So I finally, like, challenged myself to share it, and I was freaking out as I was playing it. My fingers were, like, trembling, but I shared it. And, like, I think that was a real fake it till you make it. And he was definitely faking it till he made it. He's a talented musician. He's a very good guy. But sometimes, man, faking it till you make it is, you're actually making it while you fake it.
And now, I mean, I think your songs are beautiful, and you've done so many different things with your songwriting since then.
We did one together.
All of which I want to talk about.
Yeah.
But before we talk about kind of your self-generated projects and all the different ways that you express yourself as an artist, which I find so inspiring, can we talk a little bit about how you deal with like the mainstream part of your career and like the business side of acting and auditioning and how you try to approach it without going to the dark side constantly or to make it a positive experience?
Yeah, I think I, when I came out of school, I was feeling really great about auditioning, and I feel like I got a lot of positive reinforcement from people telling me, you know, the industry is prime for you, things are going to be great, you're going to get out, you're going to book a pilot, you're going to be a movie star, you know, all this stuff, blowing so much smoke up my butt. And like, for a while, I felt pretty great just because I felt like, oh, I feel like confident in myself. I feel like I know how to, how I want to work on stuff. Treat each audition like a rehearsal, go in like ready to work and like with a sense of play and all that stuff. But then at some point, I had this one really bad audition, and there was a lot of fallout from this audition where people were like, oh, we think you've got the wrong impression of you. We don't think you're... The feedback came in and they said you're not funny. And I'm sure it was like some casting assistant had mentioned something offhand. But it turned into this whole thing, and it got in my head, and I was like, oh my God, I don't know what to think about this.
Side note, Nick is one of the funniest people I know.
3, 2, 1, Nick Choksi. And but I think there was a period where I started like trying to do what I thought they want me to do, because I thought they want me to do something that I just don't understand, and like I don't sound like the people I'm watching on TV, so I must need to do something else if I want to get this stuff. And it led to a kind of like dry spell, like a long dry period, and I think it's still something I struggle with from time to time. But the thinking about what they want me to do always, it's a recipe for disaster. And I think having been on the other side before, like you just want people to come in and do themselves and do the thing they like and that makes them excited, and it's right for some parts, it's not right for other parts. And it's tough to like let go of that chip of either A, what do they want me to do so I can do it, or B, I'm probably not going to get this. Like, that is a really not a helpful thing to go into an audition with. I've done that for commercials. I've done that for film and TV stuff, for theater, you know, where you go in and you're like, I'm probably not going to get this. And so even if you are doing your the best work you can do, you know, try not to let that into the room. Like, you know, music be the food of love, play on, you know, not like that. But like, even that thought of I probably won't get this is like not helpful. And so I try to like, I know sometimes I'll have that feeling, but try and like put that away and like remember it was like when I first got out of school, just go in, treat it like a rehearsal and have a sense of play about it. And it's a practice, not a like destination. I have to remind myself before every audition, like just go in there and meet them and do what you want to do and have a little, have a fun little rehearsal. Like Richard, our acting teacher, used to say that each audition is a chance to do your work. And it's a reminder.
It is. Yeah. It's, but it is a hard, it's a hard mindset to keep.
It's tough. I don't think there's any like, oh, I've done it. Oh, I am so zen about my auditions. I still think it's, I've got some tomorrow that I'm feeling like good about, but also I know that like 20 minutes before I'm going to be like, don't freak out.
Why is my hand shaking?
Why is my hand shaking?
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about the Food Odyssey and the band play a little bit.
Sure.
And how those projects kind of came about and how it's helped you to be a writer and a producer of your own work.
Yeah, well, Food Odyssey happened first. Perun Yusufzadeh, a good friend of ours, director extraordinaire about town. Shout out to Perone, 314, St. Louis area code. She had this idea for a play about food and our relationship to food and our relationship to the other people via food many years ago, like maybe around 2010, around the time, right after I graduated. So it started as a series of discussions with a thought that maybe we'll make a play out of this one day. And over the years, we would meet every now and then and generate stuff. And I wrote a song for it. And then it turned into a thing where, oh, maybe we think there'll be some songs in this thing. And then introduced the idea of having Odysseus and Penelope be characters. And, oh, maybe we'll make the story about them. So by the time we had, like, made the production imminent, gotten the funds together and done all that stuff, we had an idea of what the play was, but like we were writing it as it happened. And that's when we cast Ms. Leah Walsh at my strong insistence, which was an easy sell, soft sell.
I was so lucky to join it like right before you actually put it on its feet.
Right when it was getting good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, your character, we were still like really figuring out. It kind of like appeared a couple versions ago and they were like, oh, this is a great character. But it was definitely like you helped us figure out who that gal was. And there was a great moment where we got to write a song together. I don't know what you remember about it, but I remember us walking from rehearsal to the train and I was asking you a bunch of questions about Frankie and your relationship and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But I was... Special
maps.
Time. Maps.
Yeah. And then the next day I came into rehearsal and Nick just written this beautiful song that was perfect.
That was so fun.
Yeah.
But that project was the first time I'd ever been involved in a process of making a play from inception to realization. And man, it ain't no joke. It's like so amazing and so important to pursue independent work in whatever capacity. But it also takes a lot of time and a lot of fundraising mm-hmm. and then you do it and it's really special for 3 weeks and then it goes away. And like, I think there's still talk and hopes about it coming back at some point, but I don't know. It's one of those things where try and do things without thinking about the product or thinking about the goal, you know, not thinking about the destination. And sometimes you just gotta like trust that things will go the way they are going to go and need to go and just keep like putting stuff out there. And it's tough to do. And you can't like do it every day. I mean, that play took 5 years to make. But it was really exciting too to feel like we can just make something because we care about it and because we care about it and we're human and there are other humans around who will probably feel similar things to us. Somebody else is going to care about this thing and think it's, you know, touches something in them or makes them think differently about something. So it was really exciting. It was really exciting also to feel like that was the first time I had ever written music for a show. And
there were quite a few songs too.
There's a lot of songs. I think everybody had at least one song. And yeah, it was looking back at the time, I felt like it was a few too many hats, like right. being in the show and writing the songs and trying to figure all that stuff out. I'm so glad I did it all. But at the time I was just going nuts.
Yeah.
there was so much music stuff to do, writing the songs, notating them, orchestrating them, all that stuff. That the only time I had to like learn my lines was during rehearsal while I wasn't working.
And you were also the main character.
Also the main character, or at least a main character.
Yes.
But man, it was an amazing experience.
Before we talk about the band play, I've known you for a long time now. And you are someone who has always like pushed himself to the limits as far as how much you pile on your plate and how much time you're willing to give to things, which I really admire and also sometimes worry about you not getting enough sleep.
Yeah.
Because I know that like during school and then afterwards too, like you're not afraid of pulling an all-nighter.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. Where are you with that right now?
Well, that was when I was a younger man. No, it's true. I feel like...
How's your journey been with how much you're heaping on your plate these days?
I mean, I think being married has been a big, like... I mean, finding that relationship and fostering that relationship and then being married has really changed my point of view about all that stuff. Stephanie, My wife, episode two, is really good about prioritizing sleep and making sure that that happens. It's very healthy. I also floss more because of Stephanie. I'm trying to eat less sugar. I'm working on honey. I'll get there. But I feel like before that came into my life, it was really like every minute of the day is doing something, you know? And sometimes it was productive stuff and sometimes it was distractions, but it was still something. And yeah, I didn't get a lot of sleep. But I think her coming into my life and making me kind of reorganize my priorities about like, well, what quality output can I do if I don't take care of myself? That was a good shift. Also, as you kind of build a life together, you kind of pick up each other's best habits in a way. And so she right now is working this 9-to-5 job at this company, AppNexus, great company, great people. And so that's kind of dictated our schedule a little bit in kind of a good way that like she gets up at 7:30, I get up with her, make her a smoothie, make her some coffee. She goes off to work and I start my day and then she comes home and has to go to bed by like maybe 11 at the latest to get enough sleep. And so I go to bed at 11. And in a way, it's kind of like organized our day, well, at least for me, in a much more healthy way.
Yeah.
I think also there was, when I was a younger man, there was the feeling of like, you just got to say yes to every single thing. And I would say yes to everything, every reading, every drink somebody wanted me to grab, every like, go see every play, go, you know, work on everybody's project. And I think I've become a little more discerning as I've gotten older and as I've been like, you know, I don't have 27 hours in a day to give. I've got maybe this many hours because I need to give this much time to my own stuff that I find important. I need to give this much time to my life at home with my wife and our home. I need to give this much time in a week to like, you know, family and friends, and like I only have so much left over, and that's very valuable. And it'll only get more like selective when, God willing, we have a kid, you know, like it's kind of a slow narrowing to like just the most important things. So I feel like over time I've kind of been able to pare away. I think when you're young, you got to say yes to everything to like find out who you are. And then you find out who you are, and then you can just do who you are, which takes less time, but you wish there was more time, you know?
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about the band play too, because that's such a cool project. I know Brendan Spieth and I talked about it a little bit when he was on, but
episode maybe
I'll have to check. I'll look while you
We'll fact check that. We'll get the fact checkers on it. There's a whole team of people.
Idea.
It was my idea. I had this idea for a play while I was watching a bad play. And I was thinking about what kind of play I wish I was watching. And I was kind of wishing I was at a concert.
Episode four, you were right.
Episode four.
Brendan Spieth.
Listen to every episode of The Compass. It's so good. So I was watching this play. I used to watch a lot of like VH1 storytellers. I feel like that stuff is really exciting. Tiny Desk Concerts on NPR. Check that out. It's great stuff. And I had this idea about what if there was a reunion concert where some story got spilled accidentally and everybody in the room thought like, oh, is this supposed to be happening? Oh yeah, because there was this one moment in this play I saw that wasn't good, but there was one amazing moment where it was a one-man show. The guy who had written it was like a recovered alcoholic, and there was one like moment in the show where he got really emotional and everybody who knew him was getting really emotional and everybody who didn't know him was like feeling kind of awkward or odd or like, I think something is happening in the room that I'm not sure about. And no matter where people were, everybody like woke up and like paid attention. And so I was really interested in that kind of moment of, I think the person on stage is actually going through something right now, and I don't think they wanted us to know about it. So that was where the whole idea started. Like, what if that happened at a reunion concert where this band who hadn't seen each other in a long time got back together and there was some moment of realization or recognition or some change that happens like just under the lyrics, you know, that everybody felt a part of. Like, how could we make that happen? So that's where the idea started. And then I thought about who I would want to be in the band and in the play, and everybody I asked said yes, including your husband, Frankie J. Alvarez, as the kind of like host of the rock show and music historian, and Gabe Ebert and Brendan Spieth and Damon Dono and Elvie Yost as the members of the band. So that's where it started. And then we got some development time at Space at Ryder Farm to build out some things. And we had some development time at Ars Nova. We did a version of the show at Ant Fest 2 years ago. And then we did a project residency a year and a half ago where we got to, like, you know, write a whole record and like build out a two-act version of this play. So it's been really exciting, but also really like, it's tough. It's tough to get, I feel like when you write a play that's all your own, it's easy to orchestrate a reading. Hey, are you available? Can you read this part? We're going to have a reading and then just do it. But when it's six people who all have different schedules, and it actually is like the piece is dependent on those specific six people.
Right.
Being in the same room. One, I did really well picking such great people. Everybody's busy all the time. Mm-hmm. Everybody's all over the country. Oh, man. It's like, the biggest challenge of working on this piece is just getting everybody in the same room. Worth it to have, you know, the people we have.
Yeah, but of course it's a passion project and usually they're off working on things that they're getting, you know, their paycheck for.
Totally. And you can't expect people to, like, you know, prioritize this over that. Like, I haven't been able to do that either. Like, I had to leave town. Like, I don't know. I totally get it. But it is tough because I think it's something we all really care about and are excited about and are hungry for time to work on it, but are also, you know, it's difficult to find the time to work on it. Yeah. But it is a project that I really am excited about and really believe in, and also feel like the unique nature of the project, it being a reunion concert, it'll only serve us better as we get older. You know, then it will really feel like these people are coming back together after a long time.
Well, and how special it, like, I know Frankie loved creating a project with his best friend. The fact that you and he, like, really organized everything and, like, spent so much time writing and making sure that it happened. I know he loved having that time with you.
Yeah, it was so special. I was talking to my agent recently, and he was asking how the project was going, and I was saying the same stuff about it's hard to get everybody in the room. And he said, a project like that needs somebody who is going to, like, whip everybody's butts and get them in the same room. Like, a real, like, you know, taskmaster, a real, like, strong, firm hand. And I want to be that, but it's tough for me.
Well, and it's hard when you're also a performer. You're part of the cast. Yeah. So it's, like, it's not like you have a separate director who can take that role fully, or a producer who can really just be the wrangler and let you guys be the artist.
Yeah, if there was
which is hard.
If there was like a producer who was like, this is when the thing is happening, there is some compensation, even if it's like $100 for the week. Just the idea that this is actually part of my profession and not just me donating my time, even that like gesture, it does so much just mentally to put you in the space of, I can put this into my schedule as a conflict and know that, like, any workshop, if you have an audition, if you have a job or whatever, you can, you know, go do that thing. But I don't know. I feel like I've got plans for the future, but it's going to require a little bit of support, a little bit of risk and a little bit of support, and for everybody to be in the same town. Well, which will happen. It'll happen eventually.
But it's kind of that, like, two sides of the teeter-totter, let's say.
Yeah.
Like, you're making your own work, which is amazing, and I know, and you're working with people you love, and it's feeding you. And then the other side is, I'm not getting paid for this.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of my other time to organize it and produce it and back and forth.
Producing is its own whole other thing.
Yeah.
It's a learned skill, I feel like. And I'm trying to learn about it, but I'm much more comfortable on the other side of, like, the creative side. But, you know, just because I'm comfortable with it doesn't mean I should rest on it. I should try and do the other thing.
I think you're doing pretty well.
Thanks.
Can we talk a little bit about like the financial part of being an actor and the ways you've found to deal with like the ups and downs and balancing not knowing what your yearly income will be every year?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that too is something that's changed since being married. Before I got married almost a year ago.
Yeah.
You were there. Mm-hmm. Before that, my attitude towards money was very different than Stephanie's. But my attitude was kind of like, oh, it'll take care of itself. And I had that attitude. It's not that I didn't work or like, I graduated college and then I like worked in St. Louis and Chicago for about a year and a half and then moved to New York. And I kind of like, you know, built up some savings, went to New York, spent my savings and was like, oh crap, I got to get a job now. And went to a temp agency. And that was really scary for me at the time, but I like did it. So I've like done the thing of where I'm going to work to make the money. And then I'm, you know, doing the play, which doesn't pay the money. And then I went to school and forgot about money for a while. I always had this idea, for better or for worse, oh, the money will take care of itself. And it did for a while. But like, when it's just you, you know what you need and what you don't need. And so I always felt comfortable. And then when it's me and my wife, or my, you know, before she was my wife, you know, me and my girlfriend, my fiance, I think about money a little differently and think about the future a little differently. And so especially since we started getting married, since we got married.
Since
we started like the getting married process, meaning engaged.
It's never finished.
But we have to approach money together. And I've got my own opinion and she's got her own opinion, which is like, I feel comfortable knowing that I am making my living happen and I'm taking the steps necessary to do that. And if I had had that attitude earlier on, I might have been acting and also scraping by every moment I can to just increase the money in my bank account. But I kind of like let my bank account go up and down and was never starving, but like I also didn't have to get a day job. Mm-hmm. Which I felt very lucky about that. And also looking back, I could have gotten a day job and I might have a couple thousand more in the bank now, but I just didn't. But now that we're married, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit. 3, 2, 1, Dick Tracy. Okay. now that we're married, we've actually pooled our finances and we have one joint savings account and one joint checking account and that's it. And in a way it's something very emotional that we're still dealing with. It's surprisingly emotional. Like, yeah. Never experienced that before. And right now, Stephanie is bringing home most of the bacon, and I'm bringing home minimal bacon. But you know, it's like a the teeter totter. You know, then it'll come when I have a job that pays really well, I'll be bringing home the bacon, and she'll be able to not worry about so much bacon, a lot of cholesterol. So I feel like the money thing. I just think about differently now because we're trying to build a family together and
planning for the future.
And I feel like I think neither one of us can really change our fundamental feelings about money, but we're kind of moving both towards the middle between our different perspectives. For instance, I feel like in part of this always keeping busy, I would teach myself things. I learned guitar. Over the last 7 or 8 years, I've learned animation, and that's become something I'm really excited about and going down that path. But guitar, for instance, I just started learning because I wanted to, and then eventually it paid off. Been doing this show for a while now where I play guitar. And I'm getting paid to play it.
Yeah.
And like, that's only because I sat in my room and read some books and like watched some DVDs and, you know, nobody told me to, nobody paid me to do it, but now I am getting paid. And so now I feel like that feeling that used to be, what am I excited about? I'm going to go learn about it and do that, is still there, but it's more narrowed and focused to, okay, animation is something I am very excited about and I like doing. How can I turn that into something that is a means of income within my control 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road? Yeah. How can I take those steps now? So even in the individual passion pursuit, how is that still adding to the future of our family? So I feel like...
I mean, that's smart. As long as you can make, still keep your joy in it without trying to monetize it so hard that you lose why you got interested in it. But if you can turn it into like a side career, that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it would be great. It might happen. It might not happen, but I'm excited about it. And so either way, it's going to be good.
Yeah.
And I think you're right that if you try and think about the money too soon, you'll just shut down all creativity. That's, you know, that's part of the dark side. Like, sometimes I'm sitting and I'm in my, at my desk, at my new desk. Thanks, honey. That was a great Christmas present. I'm at my desk and I'm working on this little animated short that I feel like I need to make in order to, like, you know, have a little calling card of what I can do. But it's something I really care about and believe in. And I'm like taking little lessons in Maya, which is a 3D animation software, just so that I can like go down that road and see if that's something I can do, if that's a skill I can learn and then like, you know, use in the market. But sometimes I have that feeling there. This is the dark side when it comes to this, of like, I'm just making this stuff and like, will this ever like lead to a job? There are all these people who go to school for this and have done this since they were like 10. What am I doing sitting here in my room at my desk learning this stuff from YouTube?
But
what you say is true, that if you try and put the monetary value on it too soon, you will just stop everything. It's probably true for a lot of stuff. Like,
well, that's the thing that I worry about acting, is that,
yeah,
you know, when it's, you're just doing it for creativity's sake and enjoyment, it's so pure, and then when you try to monetize it, it can become this whole, when you try to make it a career, which is possible, but yeah, it comes with all these other burdens of putting this different pressure on yourself.
Yeah, it's true.
It's a fine line to walk on.
It is. I feel like the best possible organizing principle for that, I mean, it's tough to make money doing theater. It's tough. And when you do make money, it's not a lot. But sometimes you do something because you really care about it. And sometimes you do something because it's like, well, I got to keep working, you know? And both are totally valid and good. But I feel like when there are situations where there's this thing I can do, but I am not like passionately committed to it, I feel like there are times where I feel like now I have to say no to those things, because I have to look at the other side of it of like, well, that's going to take away from time, you know, with my wife, time with my own projects, time with whatever. And like, both things don't pay. But there is this other thing that I really care about. And I am going to choose to devote my time to that thing I really care about. I feel like those are the things that, even if they don't pay off, I feel like great about it. And like, when things do pay off, it's usually the project you really care about. Like, man, 3-Day Hangover, you know?
Yeah.
Like, everybody involved in that is so like committed to it, excited about it. And now they've really like blown up, you know? Or even, I've been doing this show for a while called Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. And we all started doing that show over at Ars Nova, 2012. And
oh my gosh, it's really been that long.
It's the whole length of Stephanie and I's relationship.
Oh my gosh.
I've been doing that show. But we all like really, really cared about it. And now it's coming to Broadway in the fall. And it's like, it's paying off now. Yeah. The long-term commitment to this project.
Yeah. You've definitely devoted your time.
Yeah, yeah. And everybody has. And everybody's devoted their whole selves because they care about the thing. And I've definitely been part of shows that had a lot of promise or a lot of excitement, like, oh, this is going to go to Broadway. This is going to be great. This is going to be fantastic. But the expectation of where it's going to go sometimes gets in the way of it going there. Either it makes people so afraid of negative criticism that they can't overleap that, or it makes people like doubt where they are on the track, because they're like, this is supposed to be going the whole distance and we're getting stopped up right here, so we must be terrible, you know?
Right.
This, that thinking about the outcome really makes it tough to go anywhere, because you like kind of smother the thing before it has a chance to kind of expand and find out what it wants to be.
Are you getting excited about doing your first Broadway show this
fall? Oh man, I'm so excited. I kind of can't believe it. It's been so, you know, we had this meeting with the amazing producers, Howard Kagan and Janet Kagan. We had this meeting with them in Boston where they told us this is really happening. But we had that meeting so many times. We were doing it down in Midtown and down in the Meatpacking District, because it was always almost going to happen. We had this meeting so many times where it didn't go that way that when it finally happened, it was like...
Really?
Yeah. I like screamed out loud before I even realized I was screaming with joy. But I also didn't believe it, you know? It's so exciting. It's so exciting for everybody involved. Like... one of those things, you know, the passion project thing of like people are devoting themselves to this play and this music and going home and, oh man, during that rehearsal process, I just spent all my time learning all these crazy songs on the guitar.
Yeah, because all the actors play. There's some dedicated musicians, right?
There's some dedicated musicians.
Most of the actors play instruments as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's been a couple of years since I saw it.
It's been a couple of years. It's changed. There's a big new dance break. It's totally fun. Oh, you'll love it.
I can't wait.
We dedicated ourselves to that just because it's really beautiful. And it didn't get big because there was a celebrity in it or because... it was a property people, you know, it wasn't The Wedding Singer. Or it wasn't something people, oh, I got to see that. I mean, people maybe love the book and come, but I don't know. It was successful because it was very earnest and beautiful. And it feels exciting when those things pay off. And you don't know when those things are going to pay off. And you can't do it thinking, I'm going to do this run at Ars Nova, thinking one day it's going to get me to Broadway. You can't do anything like that. But sometimes it does.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
Can we talk a little bit about what your family makes of you being an actor? And
yeah. Well, they've been amazingly supportive. I'm Indian. I come from an Indian household. My parents came here for college in the 70s, and I'm the first actor in my immediate family. First, like, person pursuing any kind of artistic endeavor. And I came to it really late when I was in college. And I think when I first started flirting with the idea, there was a lot of trepidation, a lot of like, are you sure? You know, maybe you should pick a safety job just in case. All out of like love and concern, because it's a scary thing. I mean, if our kid says, I want to be an actor, I'll be like, oh, honey, it's really tough.
Be careful.
Be careful. We'll support you. But
had you chosen another major before you found theater or not really?
No, I was kind of a free radical, you know, unsigned, unmajored person until my junior year. And I chose English Lit my junior year. And then I got an acting minor, chose that my senior year. I had taken the courses. But I think they were afraid... but then they started to understand and accept it, like, around the time I started to understand and accept it. And it was amazing. There was a period where we all knew and agreed, okay, this is happening. I'm going to try this. And then eventually we had to say it to extended family. And it was a bit scary for me and for my mom and dad. I remember sitting around with some uncles and aunties, and they said, what do you do? And I said, I'm an actor. And Mom was like, oh my gosh, that's the moment I realized that's what you do. That's who you are. And the amazing thing is all these people came out of the woodwork. I thought they were going to say, because I had been met with some like extended family who were very critical of that. Like, oh, you got to get a good job. You got to be an engineer. You got to be a doctor, got a lawyer. That's a good job. One of them said, if you've got the brain for it. And I was like, whoa, man, hey. Bleep you. Come on now.
Throw down the gauntlet.
Yeah. And it felt so insulting. And so I was scared to say that, but I said it. And then one uncle was like, you know what? I always wanted to be a singer. And then started singing to his wife.
Oh my gosh.
And I feel like there's been so much, I don't know, as a child of immigrants, you know, there's this idea they came to this country to make a better life and to make a better life for their kids and their family. And now this generation has the luxury of being able to pursue things that they really want to and not just pursue how do I make this life happen, which is like I will never be able to express how grateful I am for that and how amazed I am by that. But they've been, I think, really supportive. I mean, this is in a way exactly what they came here to do, to make this life so that the future generation could be themselves. And now, you know, we're tipping on that precipice, all of us, where we are like, all right, now we're getting ready to like invite the future generation in. We got to make this foundation strong so that they can be themselves. And we learned that from our parents of like, how do you let your children become themselves while also protecting them and making it possible for them to go to college, you know? So they've been amazingly supportive. They come see all the shows. I was on a soap opera for a while and they would DVR every episode. Mom actually, I think, got addicted to the show. I don't think she'll ever quite admit it.
Still watch it?
No, not still. It's off the air now, but...
I love your parents.
Yeah, they're great.
And then your brother does something completely different from
Completely different. He oddly...
I know, he's so proud of you.
He's the best. I'm proud of him too. He is a banker. He works with a company and kind of decides or pitches different companies to get loans from the bank. That's how the bank brings in money, by selling these loans. But he did speech and debate and drama in high school. I think partly because I did. It's like, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do it better. He's got a real, like, go get him. I'm going to be the best attitude, which has served him really well. It's gotten him into some trouble, but it also served him really well. So he came out of school, and before he graduated, he had a job at this bank, Santander, and here in New York. And he's really, like... just skyrocketed in the last, I guess, 8 years since he's been here. Wow, 8 years.
Wow.
Is that right?
I guess so.
Yeah. He's 30 now.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, but so he, although he does something completely different, he still has a real love of the arts. He's getting really involved right now on the producerial side, trying to get involved with some nonprofits. He's worked with 52nd Street Theater Project a lot. So I think he still has a deep appreciation for all that stuff and wants to participate in the way that he's really good at, which is like getting people aware of good stuff, getting people to donate to good causes. We should team up. He should be
I think we're finding the answer.
Yeah.
He should be the producer.
We did it. Episode 19, we found the answer.
You can be the creator.
Yeah.
That's fascinating to me, too, since I don't have any family in the city that you guys got to live together for a long time.
Yeah.
When you were at Juilliard and when you graduated. And
yeah.
To have somebody who knows you that well right here when you're dealing with the midst of the stress of the city.
It's a real gift. Real gift. Yeah. Him and also, you know, the family you kind of find and make for yourself. Yeah, I feel like that... inner circle, it can't be very big by design, the inner circle, but so necessary and such a blessing. they're the ones you talk to when you go to the dark side as well.
It's true, and you know that they won't judge you about it. So I know we're all getting to this age where we're thinking about if we want kids and if we want to have kids, how that'll work, being actors. Where are you at right now thinking about it and trying to figure out what that would look like for you and Stephanie, living in the city, leaving the city, both acting, both not acting?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, we definitely know it's something we want. We want it really badly. We're both very excited about it. But how to do it is really tough when there's no steady income. It almost feels, sometimes it feels like, oh, you got to get rich enough to buy a baby. That's what it feels like, you know? But it's not that way. And we have to remind ourselves that it's not that way. And my parents had, like, you know, two dimes to their name when I was born.
Yeah.
And so we will figure it out as it goes, just like everybody else did. I don't think anybody's ever ready to do it.
Yeah, there's this pressure for some reason. I feel this pressure to, like, have it all planned out and to know that it's the right time and I have the right amount of money in my savings account.
Yeah. I totally get it. I feel that pressure too.
For some very good reasons, because you don't want to be struggling when you have a newborn baby. You don't want to be struggling too much. You want to know you have health insurance. And
yeah, you don't want to be on the breadline. Yeah,
but
totally.
There has to be somewhere in the middle where you're like, oh, I can move on with my life even though I don't have everything figured out.
Yeah, yeah. And for the first few years, you have, you know, this little creature that depends upon you for everything. But then a certain point comes and you have just your family and your, like, ally and your, I don't know. It's just those first few years that are terrifying of, like, how will I make the money but also have the time to spend and also feed them and bond with them but also have to go to the show? Do I want to keep having to do shows when I have a kid? Like, all these questions come up, but we do know it's something we really want. And we have kind of, it's interesting, my wife has this great theater company called The Mad Ones, and they have a couple of awesome gigs coming up. They have a show in the fall at the Bushwick Star that they're writing. They write all their own work. And another show at Ars Nova, where they're the resident company, happening sometime, we think, in the 2017-2018 season. And so it's had to be part of our discussion in terms of, well, I know I've got this show this time and that show at that time. And so this is when we could feasibly have a kid in the next 3 years. And so we have to kind of look at a calendar.
Like, I really have to plan ahead.
Yeah. In a way, it's so daunting and crazy. And in another way, it's so helpful to, like, know, well, like, if we're going to do it, it's got to be sometime within this window. All right. But I think this Broadway gig is a real blessing in terms of that, because it's helping, you know, okay, there's going to be a job that starts in the fall and we'll pay roughly this much and we'll be pretty consistent. So have the health insurance, have the income coming in. You'll have your income coming in. And then if you need to take a step away from that, I'll have my income coming in to support us. You know, the scale will teeter. I'll bring home the bacon. Right now I'm house husband, which is also an Amazing. Equally important job. But then I'll be bringing home the bacon. But so we definitely want to do it. And I think the desire is there. The means to do it are something we're going to keep looking for.
Do you ever get excited when you meet older actors who have a family and who have kids?
Oh yeah.
Cause I get so, I'm like, I'm so happy to meet you.
Yeah.
And just to know that it's possible.
Yeah. It can work.
And that people find a way.
Yeah. I've had people say that, somebody said to me, you know, the whole thing of you put out positive energy and positive energy comes back to you, and same with negative energy, but that when you have a baby, you're just putting so much positive energy out into the world that it all comes back to you. And they say, oh, it's crazy, I had a baby and all of a sudden the job started happening. And it's not like I think that, oh, well, if we have a baby, then we'll both get famous, like, real quick. But I think maybe when I just imagine what it might feel like, I have a friend named Hank Stratton over in California, and he has a beautiful little girl who is now like 16 or something. I met her when she was a kid. And, oh man, it's crazy. But he said the moment she was born, all of a sudden his whole consciousness shifted and he thought everything I do is for this baby. And I feel like that feeling of, well, everything I'm doing is for the baby might, you know, combat some of those voices in your head of like, am I good enough? Am I smart enough? Am I going to get it? Do they like me?
Take
do they like what I'm doing?
Take the focus off of yourself.
Yeah. Like, this is a job. This is me. I'm going to go in. If you want to give me this job, good. If not, see you later. On to the next one. And like, I don't know. I feel like there might be an aid, not just in auditioning and all that stuff, but just the practicality of like, I care less about what you think of me. I'm just going to go do what I need to do and get what I need to get in order to take care of this new life. So I feel like that feeling of meeting older actors and, you know, seeing them and their families, and it's so beautiful and inspiring. And also, like, they just did it. It's not like they got permission to do it and then did it. They just did it, which is totally radical and totally empowering. And we were just talking about pre-interview. Lee and I were having a little espresso and talking about arcs of time. Delicious espresso. Lee makes a great espresso. arcs of time and how when you have a long arc of time, you can just look at time differently. Like when the kid is born, there's an 18-year arc of time you think in. So in a way, it's like when I'm thinking right now about learning this new, you know, 3D animation, for example, which is something I haven't done. I've done 2D stuff, but 3D stuff is still like, you know, in the fuzzy future. But when I think about it in terms of, okay, if Stephanie and I are hoping to have a kid, you know, within the next 2-3 years, and by the time the kid is born and I want to be able to have the option to work from home in between jobs where I can take care of our child and still let get income in. So if that's 3 years from now, for example, I don't have to feel too bad about being terrible at this right now, because I know that I don't understand it right now, but maybe a year from now, 2 years from now, I will have had so much time if I like allow myself to be bad at it for a little while in order to learn it. So that big arc of time kind of helps me, I don't know,
put things in perspective.
Put things in perspective, yeah.
Is there anything from the past few years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? It could be a project, or it could be just something that you learned or that you experienced.
I am proud of my relationship with Stephanie. I feel like we have, I don't know, it's been a real unexpected and amazing, you know, asteroid that came into my planet and it was so bright in the sky and everybody was like, oh, I'll worship this asteroid as a new god, and then it crashed and then it killed all the dinosaurs and it was like, whoa, this is a real asteroid. Oh my god, this destroyed the planet. And then, you know, we had to, you know, regrow the vegetation in this new world. But then as we regrew the vegetation and new life forms started to sprout, and we examined the asteroid and we were like, whoa, this is actually like a beautiful, strange gem that we've never even had on this planet before. We're going to start a new currency. And it just was a whole new world. And we were watching The Godfather last night. And we were talking about like going on vacation and talking about kids and thinking, man, I wish we had just a couple more years of being married before we had kids. But we're both like, you know, we have to think about both of our biological clocks, you know? And like, what if we had met each other earlier? Or what if we hadn't done all the hard work that we did when the asteroid crashed to the planet? what if the asteroid had just kind of like floated around the planet for a while? We're like, so pretty, and like kind of glided to the planet. But we look at that time and realize, like, now we get to live our lives, the rest of our lives, with this foundation of our amazingly, like, open and supportive and mutually loving and accepting and honest and totally free relationship. We get to live the whole rest of our lives like that. And it's not like it was easy to get to that point, went through some tough times, but, like, feel very proud of both of us that we, like, did something really unique and scary and ultimately so beautiful, and both had to grow up so much so fast. But yeah, I think I'm probably proudest of that.
That makes me so happy. All right. These are meaningless questions now that we've had that last one. We just need to end with that.
Yeah, bring it
on. But there's a few other ones that I always ask. Do you have any concrete things that you reach for time and again when you need to pull yourself out of the dark side? Books or things you turn back to?
I think there are a couple things. There's this book called When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron, which is... it was really helpful in terms of the idea of a whole lot of things, but fear, how we approach fear, and if we can name fear, we kind of take away its power, and sometimes we distract ourselves from feeling the fear instead of just feeling the fear and letting that be okay, and then moving forward. I feel like that book, although I don't turn back to it very often, I feel like it's kind of organized a lot of ways I think about fear and stuff. Listen to music all the time. I'm a big fan of listening to albums all the way through. And there are a couple albums that I've played, you know, X thousand times that I just find so beautiful and inspiring, like Hospice by the Antlers, just a beautiful, fully formed little quiet, hushed opera about a man at the side of a woman who's dying in a hospital. Both of Bon Iver's records just play start to finish over and over again. This album by a band called The Good Life, called The Album of the Year, which tracks this relationship from its beginning to end over the course of 12 songs, which are all are charted to 12 months of the year. The CD book was a calendar for that one, back when you actually got, you know, actual CDs with a book jacket. And this band Cursive, Tim Kasher, who is the frontman for The Good Life, also has this other band called Cursive, and they have an album called The Ugly Organ, which every artist should listen to. It's kind of, it's so good. It's kind of like the scene, the duologue between Tim Kasher, the rock god, and Tim Kasher, the battered monster who lives in the closet, and Tim Kasher, the rock god, is like, get in that closet and whips him into, you know, submission, and because he needs to write his song. So the monster is like, I woke up with this woman. I didn't even know what I was doing here. This is terrible. And Tim Kasher is like, you got to do that shit. Like, I gotta make all these songs. All these people are screaming my name. It's so, so good. Okay, Tales from the Ugly Organ.
I need to go listen to that.
And, you know, the ugly organ is the monster in the closet, but the guy who's singing is the, you know, the pretty boy everybody wants to have sex with, you know? That's really good. Also, I think the biggest thing, I journal. I try and do it every day. And if I don't do it every day, I at least journal about every day. So I've got this, like, chicken scratch record that nobody can read. From, like, when I was maybe 25 until now. It's like 9 years. And I feel like that really helps me to kind of organize my thoughts. And Faulkner has this quote about journaling. He says, how do I know what I think until I see what I say? And I feel like that helps whenever I'm processing something or upset or confused or scared or worried or whatever. Sometimes writing it down just kind of helps me see what I'm really thinking.
Are there any shows you've seen recently that really moved you or that you want to recommend?
Well, like every of your guests before, I just saw Hamilton. Yes. Holy hell.
Yeah, we haven't talked about it yet.
Oh my God, it was so good. It's really tough. Like, when people say something is great so much and you go and watch it, you just want to watch it and receive the thing, but you're also watching it and thinking about, oh my God, this is so great, like, as you're watching it. And so I watched it, and like, I don't cry a lot in the theater, or at stuff in general. I get moved a lot, but I definitely cried during Hamilton. Oh man. And like, I almost cried more listening to the record than I did during the play, because I was actually like able to not think about, oh my God, what I'm watching is so good. And just
like listening to it before the fact or after the fact?
After. We tried so hard not to listen to it before we went to see it. And we pretty much 98% did it. It was tough. It's everywhere. But we got to see it, and it was so beautiful and made us think about the future and the past. And oh man, it was so good.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Okay, I want to go back.
That conversation is to be continued.
Yeah.
Anything else do you want to shout out?
But I remember this thing my teacher said to me in college, that if this goes along with the long arcs of time thing, but she said, write down a list of things you want that you, how did you say it? 3, 2, 1, Nick jokes. things like, if you wrote down a list of things you would tell yourself 5 years from now, like, I wish I had learned the guitar, or I wish I had done this, or whatever.
Five years in the future, or five years in the future. Past.
Like, okay. if me, I was like 21 when I took that class, or 22. She was like, okay, you're 26, 27. What are 5 things you would look back at your 21, 22-year-old self and say, I wish you had done this. I wish you had flossed more. I wish you had gone to the gym consistently. I wish you had learned to play the guitar. I wish you had learned to code. And I wish you had, you know, taken up juggling. You write that list down. It's like, these are 5 things I think I feel pretty confident I would wish I had done. They're like, okay, great. Now do them. And you have 5 years to do them. And it's that thing of, I'm giving myself permission to suck at it for a while. I've talked to friends, like, I'm trying to get better at the piano. And it's really tough to do because, you know, I can play the guitar, but when I play the piano, I suck. I'm so bad. And kids can learn all this stuff and they can do it, like, learn really well because they're okay with being bad. I mean, being bad is actually really impressive for a kid. And so they have permission to just keep, dun, dun, dun. But it's really tough when you're a grown person to allow yourself to be bad at something for a while. And so I think that gets in the way of, like, progressing past that state of being bad to being okay, to being good, to being proficient, or to being proficient, to being good. And that's great. But so I think that thing she said really helped me remove the kind of obstacle in my brain of, how do I get to be good at something? Oh, I have to let myself be bad at it. How do I let myself be bad at it? I have to decide it is okay that I'm terrible at it. And of course, I have to be terrible about it because I've never done it before. And like, there's no other way. You can't just start by being good at something.
Yeah.
Unless you're Leo Walsh.
No.
And from episode 1 of The Compass,
no.
Everything's clicking along.
My goal this year is to forgive myself for not being good at it right away and to finally learn Spanish.
Oh, nice. Muy bueno.
Which, as you know, I've been saying I wanted to do since Frankie and I started dating.
But that's really good.
And now it's been 9.5 years later.
Yeah.
Almost 9.5 years later. So I'm really going to buckle down and apply myself this year.
Nice. We already have a foundation of Italian.
Yeah. And I have the Rosetta Stone. I have absolutely no excuse.
Yeah.
But I'll work on it for a month and then I'll just not touch it for 6 months. So this is the year I'm going to try to, you know, and I have someone to practice with, but I'm embarrassed that I'm not good at it, which doesn't make any sense because I've never spoken it before, really.
It's that thing of naming, this is what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of.
I just need to go for it and be okay with it.
I remember trying to learn Hindi. I've always wanted to know Hindi, but I haven't taken enough steps to actually learn it. But I do remember trying to learn it, doing Rosetta Stone and coming home and kind of testing out some of my Hindi. You know, somebody, I can't remember who, I tried to say, I'm not going to say it now because I'm embarrassed, but the word for horse. And there's this sound, I'll say it. It's like ghoda or something. And everybody who's Indian right now is going to laugh at me. It's because there's this this consonant in there where it's not ghoda and it's not ghoda. It's like ra, ra. And so I'd come to them, I'd say, horse is gora? And they'd be like, no. Is it go duh? No. And they go duh, duh, duh. And I was like, I don't know what you're saying.
I don't hear the difference.
It's because it's a consonant I've never heard. Yeah. I have no like category to put it in. But that feeling of I'm being like laughed at, not like people were making fun of me, but it would be just like somebody learning to speak English and calling a baguette like a baguette or something. You'd be like, that's hilarious. But that feeling of needing to get over that idea that you're going to have a dialect for a while, like an American dialect, and they're going to laugh just because it's funny, just like any dialect can be funny. You just got to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, thank you so, so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you wanted to share a couple of your songs with us.
So part of putting things out there that you really care about, my wife and I are working on this play with this director, Ben Kamine, about Rasputin, who's just a fascinating fellow. And so we're still in the very early phases, but one thing I've got is this very rough draft of a song, kind of folk song, about Rasputin, sung by Rasputin. If you don't know anything about the guy, look him up. He's a really crazy guy. Well, I come from the country, raised on bread and wine. I survived my mama, first of two of nine. And I beat my daddy when it was my time. Oh Lord, I've been all around this land. I went looking for Jesus, wandered here to Galilee. Sought him in the valley, the river and the tree. Found him on a mountain, Mary said he was in me. Oh Lord, I've been all around this land. I came into the kingdom to see the king and queen. Told them about the power I got from old Marie. She said, my boy is dying. I said, you leave that to me. Oh Lord, I've been all around this land. Queen told me, honey, I'm gonna do just what you say. Told her about tomorrow, like it was today. Wish I'd seen it coming when some bitch gave me the blade. Oh Lord, I've been all around this land. Had me a vision of the day I'd die. So fellas, you can't take me till it is my time. Till then I'll be dancing and drinking all your wine. Oh Lord, I've been all around this land.
Thank you for listening. listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.